From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
If America honored its national treasures the way Japan does, among my top choices would be Dan and Toby Talbot. They not only founded the legendary New Yorker Theater on the Upper West Side, but also a film distribution company that brought the work of some of the most important foreign directors to the United States. So it's with great pleasure that I welcome Dan and Toby Talbot to my show today. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Had you both been interested in films before you opened the theater?
Well, I was interested in films when I was 6 years old, going to Saturday matinees.
Yeah, well, we all like movies that way, but right. There's a big leap from that to opening a movie theater.
Right. I think we were film buffs when we, is the word courted still used? We used to go to the Beverly Theater on 3rd Avenue with Hero Sandwiches and see all the new foreign movies that were coming in. So that probably started us as film buffs together.
For those listeners who weren't living in New York at the time, can you tell us something about The New Yorker and its beginnings? It had been the Yorktown, and before that, the Adelphi, hadn't it?
The Adelphi, that was the original name in the 1930s when it was built. And when the Brandt theater chain took it over, they renamed it the Yorktown. And when We took over the theater, we renamed it the New Yorker because there were four neon, very expensive letters on the marquee, York, and we got rid of town and added new, and it was essentially a financial move, as it were.
How much did you know about how to run a cinema when you began?
Zero.
So you just
it was a learning process.
So this is just a thing where you said, like Judy and Mickey, hey, let's run a movie theater.
I think it was a little bit even more, how should we say, practical than that. We had come back from Spain with two very young children, and Dan had a notion that he didn't want to work for anyone else ever again. I was teaching at Columbia and doing some translating. And he got a column at the Progressive magazine. And then one evening, my sister's accountant came over for dinner and told us that he was going to convert this Yorktown into a Hispanic house. And Dan said, well, why don't you give me a year to experiment a while? And sort of serendipitously, that's how it began.
And did you know what you wanted to show at the beginning?
I felt my way. I certainly wanted to show high quality films. I was very interested in the American movies of the 20s and 30s, which had not been exhibited much in New York except at the Museum of Modern Art.
But there was also the Thalia in the Upper West
Thalia,
Side.
That was my school.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Toby and I went religiously every week to the Thalia to see the great French films and Italian films, and it was a great theater.
But they represented the previous generation, don't you think? They showed the great films of the past.
That's correct, and we did some of that too. But then the programming morphed into showing new films from around the world. And we had one of the biggest successes we had was the premiere of Ozu's Tokyo Story, which to our great delight ran 7 weeks, got rave reviews, And we showed films by Vida and Usman Semben and Godard, and that eventually led to distribution.
Well, we'll get to that in a moment, but how did you even wind up getting these films? Were they being made available? Were there distributors who were bringing obscure filmmakers at the time, anywhere like Usman Semben to the United States?
It was, accidental, serendipitous, and serendipitous. And in the case of Tokyo Story, this came about as a result of Donald Ritchie, mm-hmm. who...
The great Japanese writer on Japanese films.
Correct. He was working at in those years for a while at the Museum of Modern Art as a curator, and he said, "You have to see this man's work." And one day he brought a print of Tokyo Story to the theater, and Toby and I sat and watched it, and we were absolutely overwhelmed by it. And
that's because you had good taste.
Who could not be overwhelmed?
Although I know some people that's so crazy about it. There's one famous New York wag whose name I won't mention, who said, "You know, the problem with this film is it's too slow."
But let me just interpolate. In the case of Senben, we had to distribute his films. We went to Paris, and there was a French critic, Louis Marquerel, who introduced us to the young Senben, who had made two shorts, Black Girl and Barum Sered and Un Noir Deux. And we were very taken by those, and we eventually brought those in. And also Bertolucci, willy-nilly we found ourselves distributing because we saw this unknown 21 or 22-year-old Italian, and nobody wanted to bring the film in. Before the revolution. So that's really how we got... That's one of the things that we began showing.
You could say that Bertolucci founded New Yorker Films.
Because that was such a hit.
It was the first film that that New Yorker Films distributed.
Well, when did you open the theater, and when did you start New Yorker Films as a distribution company?
The theater opened in 1960. And the distribution began in 1965. And I must say that we went into distribution reluctantly. It was only because of before the revolution that we started distributing, because the producer didn't... I had asked him if I could show the film at the New Yorker Theater. He says, "No, I don't want you to give you the film just for exhibition. If you want, make me an offer and distribute it." I made an offer, and we were overnight distributors.
And I am assuming that because you were a small operation, you weren't offering lots and lots of money at
the
time.
Shall I tell you how much?
How much did you pay?
$500.
Wow. But, you know, what does that say about the situation in the film world at that time? Because Before the Revolution is deservedly a classic. Other people must have recognized it. Were they concerned that it just wouldn't make any money in America?
I would say so.
They would call it a box office risk.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, before that, Leonard, we had special series on Monday nights. And we would have, for example, a Betty Davis series. We would choose an actor or a director, a Preston Sturges series.
Kind of like what the Film Forum does today.
Correct.
Right. One night we showed Triumph of the Will, and all the kids from Columbia were coming down. It hadn't been shown for so long. So we had to have a midnight screening of that. You know, there were many things that preceded distribution.
Well, how important was it that The New Yorker was located in the Upper West Side, near Columbia, but also an area where there was a large emigre population? Were they the basis of your audience in the early days?
The young students and some of the Europeans who lived on the Upper West Side. But it was at that time, the Upper West Side was a very tricky neighborhood. There was a certain amount of crime. There was a good deal of prostitution, drugs, and it was pretty iffy at night. And it was a bit risky starting in that environment. But I would have to say that we were an instant hit. I mean, people came out of the woodworks from all over the city.
So, and you had a book in the lobby, which people would sign.
A guest book, yes.
But they also would give you a lot of complaints.
Suggestions, complaints.
A lot of complaints. The biggest crank was John Simon, I have to say. But, I mean, he's notorious for that.
What did he complain about?
Most people thought the sound was lousy. The homosexuals in the bathroom, you name it.
Could you control some of those things? Well, you could have controlled the sound. Was the projection and the sound as bad as some people felt?
I think it was acceptable. I mean, it wasn't any worse than the Thalia. Let's put it that way.
I think it was better.
Well, the Thalia...
It wasn't as good as the Museum of Modern Art, but...
The Thalia didn't have a wall between the candy machines and the audience, and so anytime
That's
anybody
true.
Went out and used one of the machines, everybody heard it. People spoke on the telephone, you heard it while you were sitting in the...
But, you know, the guest book was kind of fun, because they, just like in the old 42nd Street flea bags, the people in the guest book would talk to each other. You know, that guy is an idiot. What he's saying is, but sometimes these suggestions were constructive. They would say, "Why don't you hunt down such and such a film?"
And then somebody you didn't know, or
someone in the guest book. Mm-hmm. And then Dan felt compelled to make his own answers, saying, "We'd love to do that, but we're trying to track down the print." So it wasn't really just complaints. It was an audience that showed they were as interested in who made the film as what the story was. You know, they were really, I would say it was a formation of cinephiles.
You wound up being the place that people went if they were interested in movies, and that wound up leading Woody Allen to shoot something in the lobby.
Yeah,
correct. He did
Annie Hall.
That famous scene in which...
With Marshall McLuhan, yeah.
One wonders what they were talking about.
Woody Allen actually used several of our other theaters of ours for scenes. He used the Cinema Studio for a scene in Manhattan. And he used the Metro Theater, which we had for about 7 or 8 years up on 99th Street in Broadway, for one of his films. I can't remember the film now, but I know there were three of our theaters that he used.
My guests are Dan and Toby Talbot, who ran the New Yorker Theater from 1960 to 1973, was it?
Three, correct.
And also created the New Yorker Film Distribution Company, which was just something you say you did out of desperation. At a certain point, you must have become a victim of your own success. You were bringing in films by Godard and others for, I imagine, a little more than $500, but not big money. And he became one of the most important directors in the world. I'm sure he was, at a certain point, he or his producers said, "Hey, we can't give you these movies for those prices anymore."
That's true. Later on.
What happened?
Well, we go to festivals all year round, and we look for new talent. That's what happens. You find the new Godards or the new Sembens, and I'm thinking in particular of this African director, Idrissa Ouedraogo, who made a magnificent film called Yaba.
He's from Burkina Faso.
He's from Burkina Faso, and we saw it at Cannes, and we were just overwhelmed by the film. And I made a deal for that. If we didn't pay $500 for it, but we were able to compete and get it. And I can't say that it was very successful, but you know, we survived with it.
I was pleased. It brought him to the show.
Right.
That's right.
In fact, any number of the directors, Ousmane Sembène has been on the show.
Oh, really?
Yes. One of my great pleasures. But since some of these films are so important to film history, can I assume that if you hadn't brought them to the United States, somebody else would have, at least eventually?
I think so. I mean, I think that there's a whole new generation of cinephiles who, with some modest backing, have made attempts to bring worthwhile films. I'm thinking of Wellspring Films, for example, which is no longer with us. And there is Kino International has done some very fine work. And then you have the Zeitgeist Film now is doing some good work. So, I mean, these people are around. There are at least a half a dozen distributors with good taste and distinction who are carrying on.
But, you know, I have to say that we were kind of lucky. We were timely because the 60s was an explosion of cinema as it was an explosion in politics. So all of the Latin American cinema, we brought in all of the Brazilian movies, all of those essentially political movies. So there was a convergence. It was such an explosive period. It's hard to imagine that, you know, we said, okay, today we'll go to Bergman, tomorrow we'll go to Godard, tomorrow we'll go to Glauber Rocha. We thought, yeah, that's what cinema is.
And Japan was also producing
films
at the time.
So
this was a great moment for films into the 70s.
Right.
Is the business harder these days because there aren't as many good films?
Absolutely. There's certainly a decline. I don't know how to put my finger on it, but there is a decline. We have to look at many, many more films in order to find the handful of films that we deem to be worthwhile.
I'm sure that the first person to show the film, so the first people to show the films that you were bringing over were you at the New Yorker, and then there are some other theaters which we'll get into in a little while. But other than your own theaters, who were you sending these films to? Were there other theaters around the country that were calling you and saying?
Yes. They still exist. You know, in the 60s and 70s, there were in the United States there were about 600 first run art theaters. Most people don't know that, who regularly show the films of Truffaut and Bergman that Janus had acquired.
Have they all disappeared? Is there an art theater in Kansas City anymore?
No. Sad to say no, but there was one actually in the 60s and 70s. I know I showed we showed Marriage of Maria Braun in Kansas. But there is a circuit of very fine theaters around the country. I don't know the numbers because there's a crossover between the large multiplexes who try occasionally to do what they deem to be, to use that silly word, art movies. And there was a fellow in San Francisco, Mel Novikoff, who's no longer with us, who had four or five theaters which were among the best theaters in America. They were beautiful theaters, the Clay Theater and the Surf Theater.
The Castro.
Mm-hmm. It's now part of a chain, the Landmark chain. The Lemleys in Los Angeles have always had a group of wonderful theaters. There, you have the Music Box in Chicago, and the Eugene Siskel Film Center, which is programmed by Marty Rubin, who writes our film catalog. Is also a very fine theater showing the best.
You know, I think we ought to mention as well that there is what we call the 16 millimeter circuit, which is the university circuit, and it's more powerful than in other countries, in Europe, for example. So a lot of young students get their cinema education through that 16 millimeter market.
Because teachers bring them in teaching courses, and there's always some kid who has a bright idea of, hey,
right,
let's show good movies.
Student society, right.
Now, what happened when New Yorker Films took off? Were producers and directors calling you and saying, please take my film because nobody else in America wants it?
Yeah, I would say so. I think we established a track record, and this is we're now talking about the 1970s before the classics divisions cranked up, and we had first crack at a lot of new work around the world.
Fassbinder, Herzog.
So you introduced all of those directors, filmmakers to America?
Yeah. Fassbinder especially. He was a discovery for me.
Fassbinder was successful here before he was successful in Germany.
Well, there's the whole matter of whether a film opens to a lot of money or whether a film has a longer life. And most of the films that you have shown, that you've distributed, have these catalog lives. After Talladega Nights will be long forgotten, we will still be seeing Before the Revolution. So did it take a while for the bigger distributors to realize that both can turn a profit? Or are they still not interested in those kinds of films?
A lot of them are not. I think they're interested in, you know, I can name some titles, but they're interested in films that they deem to have a higher profile. But I don't think that they're going to experiment too much with some of the newcomers from China or
Turkey
mm-hmm. or, you know, or even some of the French newcomers.
And initially the Iranian films.
And the Iranian films, which we introduced to this country. They're still not running after Iranian films.
But one of the big differences is that when you got started, Italy, France, Germany, they were the major foreign film producers, Japan. And now it's Iran, it's Taiwan, recently is Senegal, Burkina Faso.
Right.
Everything has changed.
Right.
In the end, because do you think art films got tired in some of the countries that have been making them for so many years?
I don't know that they got tired. I think
we don't see a lot of great films coming out of France anymore.
No, but they're making not great films, but they're making workmanlike films that are interesting. I mean, I think that I could probably name a half a dozen French directors who are of interest. You know, they have an easier situation there because they're subsidized by the government. The Centre du Cinéma tools up money to develop their films. And they're still making some reasonably good films in France. I mean, they're not experimental. They're not new. They don't break new paths, but they're interesting.
Now, why did you give up the New Yorker Theater? You sold it to Walter Reed, didn't
you? I have
you?
To say my wife is still, she's glaring
at me. That was the only moment when I considered divorce.
I have to say that I'm responsible for it, not she. I regret it deeply.
Well, you're going to write a book, aren't you, Toby?
Yes.
So yes,
you
can but get your revenge. I will not dedicate it to him.
out of boredom.
Really? But you've opened up other theaters.
Well, I realized after I sold it 3 years later that I made a mistake.
No, and that you missed running a theater.
I missed mm-hmm. having a theater.
So now you have the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas.
Well, before that, the Cinema Studio.
Mm-hmm. And the Metro.
Well, the Metro came a little later. And then the Lincoln Plaza, which we built in 1981.
I'd like to mention something about our staff. At the New Yorker, a young Cuban came on an airlift. He was 15 years old, and he had his first job as an usher at the New Yorker Theater. And he now, at the age of 50-something, 60, runs New Yorker office. And the staff down at the Lincoln Plaza, each person comes from somewhere else. It's really quite beautiful to see the harmony with so many people working together from different places.
A rainbow coalition.
One of the saddest moments for me was when the Art Deco relief of Diana the Huntress, which hung under the marquee of the New Yorker, toppled over in the middle of a storm.
Right.
And it's kind of stayed there in a saddened state for years. When you went by, it was no longer your theater. When you went by, you must have felt awful.
Not good.
Any guilt? Because that
not
was such
guilt,
a great
but,
theater.
Sorrow.
No, for me, the saddest moment was when the theater was actually demolished with Diana.
And as I said, Toby, there's going to be a book. How far along is that?
Oh, the book is quite finished now, actually. And, you know, it's one of these projects that could be interminable because if I speak to scholars, they say, well, you have to include all the programs so that young curators have access to it. And then other people say, well, you have to have people who are in the neighborhood who used to come. And other people say you have to have all that was happening up at Columbia where I was teaching. So it's...
What happened to the audience that you had been so loyal after you closed the New Yorker?
Well,
they didn't have the book to write in anymore to complain to.
No, but they showed up at the Cinema Studio, and they and at the Lincoln Plaza, and they still come.
But there's another thing which is very nice. It's like having children. Many of the young people who came, like Hoberman and Denby and Philip Lopate, they prolonged it. They continued it. And we opened also at a certain point the New Yorker bookstore with Pete Martin, who had started City Lights Bookstore with Ferlinghetti. That bookstore was a very special bookstore. It was upstairs. We carried a lot of film books, a lot of literary books, and we showcased a lot of young neighborhood writers. So, what Bertolucci called it, a kind of wild cinematheque. And I think a lot of young people got their education there.
Because in France, it was the cinematheque that people went to and said that they learned about movies.
I don't think it was, as we say in Spanish, punto final with the New Yorker. It had a resonance.
And now you have theaters where you're doing pretty much the same thing, or has the business changed so much that you really had to adjust?
Pretty much the same thing. I mean, since we have to fill 6 screens 52 weeks a year, there are occasionally borderline films that we will book that I'm not totally unhappy about it.
Especially if they make real money.
Huh?
Especially if they make real money and subsidize the rest.
You know, the theater is financially successful, so I'm not concerned about whether an individual film makes money or not, except for the filmmaker or the distributor who's given us the film. But by and large, look, we look at over 300 films a year before in making our selections, and out of 300 films, we'll wind up showing somewhere between 30 and 50 films.
And I want to thank you both so much for showing those 30 to 50 films every year, Dan and Toby Talbot. It's been a great pleasure talking with you today.
Same.
Thank you
for having us.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.